This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. The Emancipator is back. The original was the nation's first abolitionist newspaper, founded in 1820, partially based in Boston. 200 years later, the Boston Globe and Boston University's Center for Anti-Racist Research have brought it back and brought it forward to today's journalism, today's digital world, today's issues. And they started by focusing on the Black racial wealth gap. Kimberly Atkins-Storr is the senior columnist for The Emancipator and the author of its first series, which published this week. She's also an alumna of WBUR. Kimberly, welcome back.
Hi, Tiziana. It's great to talk to you.
So, Kimberly, here you are. You're reviving a storied publication. It's got a history of speaking truth to power. I have to imagine it was a huge task to decide where to start. How did you do that?
Well, it was a huge task to bring it to fruition, and we're very excited that that happened. But actually, for me, figuring out where to start was very easy. For a long time, I have thought about the racial wealth gap just from my reporting in my 20-plus years in journalism, and also from my personal experiences. And there were a lot of things about it that, as I searched for more information, it really wasn't available or not crystallized in a very easily understandable way to help even me understand it fully. And so that was one thing that I wanted to do. I wanted to take a look at the racial wealth gap specifically, some of the things that contribute to it, and really present it in a way to all Americans to make it as clear as possible why it's so important to fix it, because fixing it helps all of us, not just Black people. It helps everybody.
So there are a couple of things I want to note here. One is the thunderclap of a report in 2015 called The Color of Wealth in Boston. And I think lots of WBUR listeners have heard these numbers over the last few years. You know, this massive gap, $8 in wealth for the average Black family, $247,000 in wealth for the average white family, not a typo. Did you find that those kinds of disparities were beyond Boston? And where did you turn to learn more?
Yes, they definitely are. I mean, I think Boston serves as a great example, sort of a microcosm of the way the racial wealth gap looks throughout the country. And that report, which was very important, focused on some of the really core areas, things like housing and the fact that since the beginning of the enslavement of humans in this nation, there has been a prohibition or barrier set up to land ownership. Enslaved people were not alone were not allowed to own land. There were barriers to freed people trying to buy land. And to this day, there is structural racism in housing that causes a lot of this inequality. We know property ownership is just a fundamental part of wealth. So that's a big part of it. But there are also other things that lead to that. And those are the things that I got into this report. It's also important to know, I know some good journalism has been done on the racial wealth gap. I'm not suggesting that it's not. But what we want to do at The Emancipator is really focus on solutions. It's solutions-based journalism that empowers not only those at the highest level of power, but every single person, gives them a roadmap about what they can do to help create a more just society. It's not just looking at the past. It's really looking at the future.
Yeah, I did notice, and in a second I want to dive further into the content, but I did notice in reading them, they're set up almost like policy briefs in that the first half really educates the reader, and then there are very concrete policy recommendations in every case. I'm assuming that's the model we can look forward to going forward.
Certainly. I mean, I think that's the importance for me. As a journalist, I sometimes often feel like I'm screaming into the void, even when I'm writing about or reporting on or talking about things that are really important. And one thing I want to try to do here is really engage the audience to be invested in this. I start off by making points such as, you know, the racial wealth gap costs everyone in the last 30 years alone, $51 trillion. It costs the U.S. economy, the racial wealth gap. That's costing me money. It's costing you money. White people, Black people, all people. And I hope that taking that approach makes it really clear, brings people in and says, well, I don't want anything to cost me money. Is
right.
there a way
right.
that
it's
I could
a shared
help?
Experience.
Exactly. Be a part of this solution. I also frame it in terms of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, you know, a fundamental American ideal. And say we're supposed to be able to work hard, do what we're supposed to, and we should have a shot at the American dream. But there are barriers in place to some people that prevent that. And I would think that all Americans would say, well, that's not right. If people are doing the right thing, working hard, contributing to society, they should have the same shot at success as anybody else. And I think looking at it that way really, I hope, invests people in not only learning more about this, but doing what they can to be a part of the solution.
So, Kimberly, the three pieces in this first round, you focus on credit, you focus on student loan debt, and then you focus on the one we're going to do here now, which is the journey and the experiences of Black-owned businesses. I want to bring in a second voice to join our conversation as we do this. Glenn Lloyd is the CEO of the Foundation for Business Equity, which is a nonprofit that helps support Black and brown entrepreneurs in Boston. He founded City Fresh Foods, which delivers ethnically diverse food to elders and others. Glenn, thanks for joining this conversation.
Great to be here, Tiziana.
So as a Black business owner in Boston with a lot of entrepreneurial experience, did Kimberly's piece about that about the structures and systems for Black-owned businesses resonate with you?
It absolutely did. I mean, for anyone who knows anything about small business, it's hard enough to really start and grow a business. Some folks have a great idea. You know, you got to build your team. Clearly, you have to then find the right capital. And then you're not going to grow without, you know, access to a market, understanding your customer. And that's hard enough for any business owner. And then when you weigh in the microaggressions and the structural racism that exists with a lot of these institutions and networks and so on and so forth, it's all the more harder. And then the results bear it out, unfortunately, right, in terms of the stats.
Is there a particular story that came back for you in reading Kimberly's piece from your own experience as an entrepreneur?
Yeah. I'm also working with, you know, dozens and dozens of Black and Latin-owned businesses, and we see it all over the issue, all over the place. And also, I've had the chance to work with some of the banks here in the greater Boston area, and also, you know, talking with the VCs and the angels. And unfortunately, even if you just look at capital alone, the most recent report came out from Mass Inc. and Boston Indicators, you know, we're talking about a $600 million annual gap in capital that folks are looking for it, and they're just not getting access to it. And then you see that individually. I've seen really smart, capable entrepreneurs, trying to raise their first seed round. And just, you know, there's a lot of no's typically, but just an inordinate amount of denial. So that's just one example, Tiziana. We see it across the board in terms of some of the structural challenges. I mean, just, you know, your basic network, right? A lot of success has to do with who you know. And what school you went to, and so we see that we're in some ways lacking some of the kind of robust networks that kind of get you over the edge. And so again, the examples abound, unfortunately.
Kimberly, let me just let you react to what Glenn's saying.
Yeah, no, I think what he's saying is very important, both about the barriers that exist and the different ways that we can think about finding solutions. You know, my piece was not meant to be exhaustive. In some of the recommendations that it faced. One key thing that needs to be done is getting more money in the hands of Black wealth management managers and lenders and other people who can know and lend to Black businesses. Also, another core piece is getting the community involved. A lot of times you have banks, you know, lenders who are sitting looking at a cold record or evaluating a business without really having a firm understanding about how opening this business can help a community. The community investment in having this business there. So when you bring community members into the equation and they vouch for these businesses, that causes banks to have more faith in these businesses and that allows these businesses to thrive.
So, Glenn, I want to pick up on that, and then we'll come back to the money again in a minute. But this idea that there are, to use an economics term, really important externalities that come from businesses of color being successful, the way they grow a community, a neighborhood. As I was reading that in Kimberly's piece, I was thinking of you and the work that you did with City Fresh Foods to create an employee-owned business, right? A business that brought money back into the community in a number of ways. Talk more about these amplifying effects, how, you know, a rising ship rises the tide, really the backward of what we usually say.
Yeah, I mean, I'm glad you brought up City Fresh, which is something dear to our heart here, is you know, it's been a work of art for decades, and it's a kind of a community institution, right? Lots of payroll runs through our business. Also, we're feeding a lot of folks, hopefully to consider it very healthy food. And so, you know, the amplifying effect of having an institution like this in the community, hopefully, you know, one day we should measure all the benefits, but, you know, the real estate that we've been able to develop through it. So these are the things that if you look at different communities, typically the strength of the entrepreneurial community within kind of racial groups is very important. And folks come to rely on these institutions to support the community in broader ways, right? You know, community input, philanthropy, all that stuff really is flowing through the business sector, and so there's no reason why we should not have just as much strength and with our entrepreneurs to strengthen our communities.
So, Kimberly, we talk about access to capital. Glenn's talked about the money. You talked about it in your piece. What was playing in the back of my head was the challenges we've seen in the last few years in the growing cannabis industry, that Massachusetts had this intention of creating equity opportunities for people and communities that were disproportionately impacted by marijuana policy. And one of the biggest problems, one of the biggest barriers to entry for entrepreneurs of color has been getting money. Now, I know there's a special factor there because federally, marijuana is illegal, and so that also has a chilling effect on investors. But, I mean, there is a case example that we are living out right now in a place where Massachusetts was intentional in what it wanted to do. So now that we are at least becoming intentional in our awareness, what are the changes that this community, Kimberly, can make in 18 months, 24 months, 36 months, that will really begin to have an impact?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great example. And yes, it is federal policy, which is crucially important in this case because federal policy governs banks. So it is difficult, if not impossible sometimes, for people who own a legal marijuana business in Massachusetts to even be able to take out a mortgage, let alone take out get access to business capital to open those businesses because of federal prohibitions there. But that, I think that's a good example that shows, look, even where you have an industry that is facing industry-wide its own barriers, its own problems, when you multiply on top of that the specific barriers that Black and brown folks face, it just shows how much more dire the situation is and how much more communities, leaders, lawmakers need to be invested in removing those barriers. One thing I do want to say is that some response that I've gotten from the series is from people who say, you know, I'm a white business owner and it's hard for me too. I've had to work hard. Nobody gave me any special shot, or, you know, this is why should we be giving money to people who aren't working hard enough? This is meant to dispel some of those myths and say, look, a lot of the solutions that are proposed in the series won't just help Black people. It will help disadvantaged white people, disadvantaged people of all races, because it's about equality. And I think if we start from that point and invest in everyone in it, we can find solutions, not only the ones that are proposed here, but think out of the box to think of more to ensure that everyone succeeds.
So, Glenn, let me let you pick up that thread and react.
Kimberly, I'm so glad. I just want to say that you brought that up around other businesses, because in general, small businesses are up against it, right? Because they're going up against, you know, corporate size entities that own broader market share. You know, there's a loop between Wall Street and how the capital flows. And so small businesses in general are a disadvantage, I'll say. And then when you layer on the racial lens, it's even harder. So I do, you know, for our white allies who are also trying to grow their businesses, a lot of these tools we're talking about. I also quickly would want to say, for me, there's kind of two paths to this. One is the traditional infrastructure, banks, VCs, and angels, how do you push them to do better, right? And so that's, and, you know, people say, well, don't hold your breath, but I think we're seeing some cracks there. But also what we focused on is creating alternative, right? So there's things like CDFIs, community development finance institutions that I help run as an example. How do we get resources into these spaces that just the old traditional system is just not going to get there fast enough? So I want to highlight that.
And so I just want to feed this back, Glenn, to make sure that I've got you. You're saying there's two stages to this. Yes, we have to change existing institutions, but we've got to build new ones without the baggage.
That's correct. And I think, I mean, I'm actually very proud of our state, Massachusetts, because there's been some work, Coalition for Eco Economy, which is driven, it's a multiracial kind of advocacy group, really pushing resources in, you know, working with the governor's office and Secretary Keneally's office to do as best we can around where the gaps are and making sure those institutions are doing a better job. But yes, to the end of it, there's nonprofits and the CDFIs that actually can look at underwritings differently and can take more risks. And we can use philanthropy and other government kind of type resources to help, get resources into these spaces where typical banks and other VCs and angels wouldn't. And so I think it has to be a combined effort.
All right. And that is Glenn Lloyd, CEO of the Foundation for Business Equity, and Kimberly Atkins, Store senior columnist with The Emancipator from the Boston Globe and the BU Center for Anti-Racist Research. The Emancipator launched this week with a series that Kimberly Woke wrote based on the Black racial wealth gap. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you for having me, Tiziana.
Thanks.
Harvard has come out with a report that looks unflinchingly at the university's relationship with slavery. It also makes commitments to begin to atone for that history. Here's Harvard's president, Lawrence Bacow, on the university's promises.
We will recognize the injustices that the committee's report so carefully documents. We will redress through teaching, research, and service our legacy with slavery. And we will work across the university and in partnership with other institutions to fulfill our moral obligations.
WBUR education reporter Max Larkin has been covering the story of this 400-year-old institution's reckoning. Max joins us now. Max, welcome back.
Thanks for having me back.
So let's start with the rundown, Max, the headlines from the report. How deeply was Harvard engaged with slavery?
Yeah, pretty deeply, I think, is the answer. The report names and identifies dozens of people who were held in slavery by Harvard's president and its faculty during its first 150 years as an institution. And then up to and even after the Civil War, it documents large gifts coming in from either slave owners or their families, and gifts that went on to build up Mass General Hospital, Tiziana, or the law school or the medical school, some of the really highest profile parts of Harvard's footprint. And then those are just the most direct ties.
So these roots run deep. And so listen, what I'm going to say next is not to excuse anything, because it doesn't. But many people still think of Massachusetts as an abolitionist state, yet slavery was legal and practiced here in the Commonwealth when Harvard was founded, right?
Absolutely. I'm not a historian, Tiziana, but yeah, slavery was legal in Massachusetts until 1783. And the state census shows that it's sort of fully phased out by 1790. You do, of course, have the original emancipator here, William Lloyd Garrison writing, Frederick Douglass visiting, speaking here. But then you have a century and more of darker history beforehand, where it's estimated that at one point, 12 to 15% of Boston residents were enslaved, where Brookline, then called Muddy River, was among American communities with the highest density number of enslaved people. And of course, Harvard was right there for all of it.
So the university now has been reckoning with its racial history. This is not its first step. It's been in the news over a court battle with a woman who claims to be the ancestor of enslaved people in a series of famous and troubling daguerreotypes that Harvard owns. She wants the university to give them to the family. So there's some work that's been done here. We know there's a history. But are there surprises in the report, Max?
Yeah, I think the report is quite thorough and actually worth reading. You can find it on Harvard's website. You do see, I think, 20 or so of the 130 plus pages deal with the years during and after the Civil War. So you have some acknowledgement that there were follow-on effects from America having been a slave republic. But this is really focused, I'd say, on slavery directly. As far as kind of little surprises. They mentioned thousands of people's remains in Harvard's archives, Tiziana, mostly indigenous people, but at least 15 who were of African descent and possibly themselves enslaved. It's also worth noting.
I'm sorry, human remains, right? I want to be clear about that because that is surprising.
Yeah, human remains. You have a place like the Peabody Museum where the daguerreotypes are kept. They also have skulls and bones, things from burial sites. And then I think the report justly sheds light on Harvard's participation in the movements that we now think of as abhorrent, scientific racism and eugenics. I could have read even more about that, but it was well done to include them.
All right, so now Harvard's put $100 million on the table. What are they going to do with the money? Is this reparations in their mind?
I feel like that's a tightrope we're kind of walking this week with the coverage. We don't yet know what they're going to do with the money. Harvard is not the first school to do this, Tiziana, and it's not clear what model they'll follow. So you have Brown University now a decade and more out from their own slavery reckoning. Their support notably took the form of like educational investments, including support for the Providence Public Schools. And you have Georgetown, by contrast, they set up a fund that they hoped would generate $400,000 a year in support for the descendants of enslaved people who were sold by the school years back. Their student activists say that money has not materialized yet, but it may soon. So we don't yet know which of those two directions Harvard will pursue or something else. They've sort of indicated interest in both, but it will fall to a university committee to make concrete spending decisions down the line.
What are you hearing in reaction to the release, Max?
Because of that sort of vagueness, I think there's some criticism, some skepticism, some sense that this could, you know, we don't yet know how substantial this will be. I spoke to Reggie Stewart, who is a part-time reparations activist based in Dorchester. He said so far it feels glossy, certainly well-funded, but like public relations.
You know, $100 million is a lot to the average person, but when you put it in context of what Harvard has stolen and hoarded over centuries, it's really nothing.
Stewart has been among the people supporting the Connecticut woman Tamara Lanier's case for those daguerreotypes. He said giving those back and not fighting that her claim in court would mean something substantial. And he also noted that real estate prices in this city are elevated in part because of Harvard's big expensive footprint here. And he asks, is Harvard ready to fight for rent control in the city of Boston, Cambridge, let alone reparations?
So what about students, Max? How are they reacting, those who are there now?
Yeah, I spoke to Christian Gines, who's a freshman from Mississippi. He's a Black student, and he happens to live in Massachusetts Hall, which is the oldest building on the campus. I think it dates to 1713. He says he came to Harvard inspired in part by Black thinkers before him who'd done the same. So W.E.B. Du Bois, Cornel West, Fred Moten among them. But then having come here and spent much of his first year here, that's not the only history he feels on campus, especially in that old dorm he lives in.
We know a bunch of old famous Harvard people just like in general lived here. And some of these people are also slaveholding. So it just goes to like that legacy of like, it's almost, and sometimes it feels like you're walking with the ghosts of the past.
Back in February, Tiziana, Gines wrote an editorial in the Harvard Crimson arguing, in short, that Harvard can't really atone for its ties to slavery. Not that they shouldn't try, but he says that a real atonement would mean giving up those problematic things in its archives, abandoning what he says are unethical investments in private prisons or foreign real estate, shedding its elitism, that sort of thing. And then arguably, he says Harvard wouldn't be Harvard at the end of that process.
So last question, Max, just briefly, why now? Why is Harvard doing this now?
I think there's more to say there. They had launched a very similar initiative under their prior president, Drew Gilpin Faust, who was herself a Civil War historian, but it didn't materialize into this kind of commitment. I think there's a lot of scrutiny on places like Harvard because their endowment grew by over $10 billion last year. And certainly it's a moment of real heightened racial consciousness, history consciousness in this country. And, you know, they're about to be fighting an affirmative action case in front of the Supreme Court. So I think there was a sense that they wanted to take a moral stand here, and we'll see what comes of it.
All right. WBUR education reporter Max Larkin. Thanks, Max.
Thanks for having me.
Swaths of Massachusetts are getting ready to turn 400. Gloucester hits the big 400 in 2023, and in preparing to celebrate, they wanted to honor 12,000 years of human history in the region before that. The Cape Ann Museum in Gloucester has hundreds of artifacts from Native communities and cultures that predate colonial settlements, and the museum has partnered with local historical societies, Indigenous communities, to bring those artifacts to the public with insight and with context. Oliver Barker is the director of Cape Ann Museum. David Whedon is Tribal Historic Preservation Officer for the Mashpee Wampanoag Tribe, and he recently participated in one of the events put on by the Cape Ann Museum. They both join us now. Oliver, David, welcome.
Thank you, Tiziana. It's a pleasure to join you again today.
Great to have you both. So, Oliver, I'm going to start with you. What is the museum featuring in these programs?
Well, this is a little bit of background. For close to 150 years, the mission of the Cape Ann Museum has been to share the power of stories, to thrill, to teach, to inspire, and to forge connections with others past and present, and clearly to also celebrate and share the inexhaustible human spirit that has animated and enriched this corner of the earth for centuries. So taking that mission, we've been very conscious as Gloucester approaches its 400th anniversary next year to shine a light, as you said in your wonderful introduction, on the very long and deep history of the Indigenous peoples in the area of Cape Ann.
So, Oliver, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, please, go ahead.
Well, so important to do that well, right? To do it right. So how did you make sure you sort of did it right?
Well, I will admit that as a museum, we don't have all the answers. And so that's why we turned to David and Linda Coombs and other colleagues to help us better tell the story from an Indigenous perspective. We are keen to learn and we are keen to get it right. And we understand that there is a process there involved. But as we don't have that in-house expertise, we were so delighted to partner with David and others in beginning to understand this important narrative.
So as we turn to David, I'll note Linda Coombs is an historian that we've had here on the show more than once before too. So David, I want to ask you, were you familiar with the Cape Ann Museum and its work before this collaboration? And tell me about your impressions of the museum as you began to get involved. Well, I wonder.
Thank you for having me. I was not familiar with the Cape Ann Museum. I haven't interacted with them very much. I don't often make it out to that part of the state. It's quite a distance from Mashpee. I find myself really busy and unable to explore or appreciate that section of the state. After going there for the talk that they had asked me to be a party to, it's a beautiful facility. It's in a historic building that's been well maintained. They have some really interesting exhibits. It seems to be really managed well. And that was about the extent of my
previous exposure. Right. And I am going to note for our listeners, we have a little bit of a line delay with you, David. So I'll take a longer pause after my questions as you jump in. So Oliver and David, one of the things that was fascinating to me in preparing for this is learning about sort of the relationship between how a museum curates artifacts and how an indigenous archaeologist might think about where artifacts belong and how. So let's start with you, Oliver. What are some of the artifacts that you're bringing forward? And did you have to do more work about their history, their provenance? How did you think about that as you were choosing in this moment when we're having such an awakening to our history to bring those forward?
Well, in understanding that as a museum, we don't have all the answers, all the in-house expertise, we actually did reach out to Eric Lott, who is a member of the Massachusetts Archaeological Society at the Robbins Museum of Archaeology. And he very generously came to the museum and assessed our modest collection of artifacts that we have. It's a collection of artifacts that were amassed by an amateur archaeologist, Carlton Phillips, between 1930 and 1941. And Phillips, with a team of assistants, explored known and suspected sites across Cape Ann. And as a result, our collection includes pottery shards and stones sharpened in a variety of shapes for different purposes, including fishing, hunting, and food preparation. And from the collection itself, and with the input of Eric Lott and others, we are able to make some important assumptions about the living patterns and the daily lives of the people that were the original inhabitants of Cape Ann and through coastal New England.
No, it's okay. Finish that thought and then I'll turn to David.
Well, it was just the display of these artifacts comes from a wide variety of areas across Cape Ann. I just think it's a very exciting group of objects that point back to earliest known existence some 10,500 to 11,000 years ago.
So, David, your title is Tribal Historic Preservation Officer. And I am fascinated by the idea of how you think about archaeology, how you think about artifacts, how you think about preservation. So what did you want to bring to this relationship? And what were you hoping to do in educating people?
A lot of people are, you know, only familiar with archaeology with, you know, like Raiders of the Lost Ark and that sort of thing in other countries. But they fail to realize that as far as here in America, the archaeology as a science is something that wasn't widely implemented. It hasn't been around for a very long time. A lot of the laws came about in the 50s, 60s, and 70s to where there's more stringent laws that require archaeology on specific types of projects. So my job as a historic preservation officer, we engage with a lot of federal agencies that have regulatory and permitting requirements to comply with those stated laws that apply to archaeology. And, you know, in doing so, there's a constant effort and balance for us to try to protect archaeological interests that are unbeknown to ourselves. We've lived here for 20,000 years. Our oral histories tell us that we've been here since the beginning, since times immemorial. The archaeology as a science has us here roughly 15,000 years. And, you know, with that, there's no way for us to actually capture and retain every location where things are buried in old villages and habitation sites. That's quite impossible. So we rely on archaeology to find locations where there's known sites, and then there's a lot of information that can be gained from those sites. The only thing that we object to is when they start finding burials and things that you're going to, you know, there's cultural conflict with digging and probing around those types of spaces. But there's a, you know, so there's an effort to try to avoid, minimize, and mitigate in those types of situations. Because the laws are fairly new laws, a lot of museums across the country have retained artifacts and collections that were acquired through amateur archaeology and those are, things. But, you know, tribes typically across the country have a moral obligation to try to preserve and protect things that are proprietary in nature, and some things are ceremonial in nature, and so it's good to nurture relationships with museums so that there's collaboration and discussion on what is sacred and what isn't, what's appropriate for display and what's not, and those types of things.
Thank you for that, David. So in listening to you, and Oliver, I'll turn to you to ask this question. David, the word that stood out for me was things. Because Oliver Museums, you know, I'm not a curator, right? I don't direct a museum. I am a consumer of museums. And I think of them as places where I go see things, to learn things. And you invested in more than things here. You also invested in wisdom and education. So let's talk about that, especially given the sacredness of some of these things and the troubling history of them having been disturbed. How does a museum move beyond things to tell us important stories?
Well, I think these things all have a story to tell. And we are so keen to unlock those narratives and to share them with the public because it is part of our collective history. And I believe, and we are deeply at the CAPAM Museum committed to the idea of uncovering those narratives. So I think one of the key things that we've done in relation to this collection over the past several months, and in partnership with the other institutions in our local area with whom we have been working, the Manchester Historical Museum, the Sandy Bay Historical Society, and the Annisquam Historical Society, we have really taken an opportunity to review and catalogue our respective Indigenous collections. And with the information that we've gleaned through that effort, each institution has now made a commitment to displaying those artifacts. And hopefully with visitor input and input from the Indigenous peoples as well, a better understanding how they were used, what they were used for, and making sure, of course, that we always display things respectfully. So I'm very excited for the partnership that has come about, and delighted to learn, of course, of this growing interest in Indigenous history, both past and present day in Caban and Essex County.
So, David, we have at most a minute left. So just in a sentence, what would you hope visitors to these exhibits would learn?
I think the common theme is that, you know, as these towns and municipalities approach their 400th anniversary, history didn't start at 1620. The idea and towns do historic investigations as to historic sensitivities within their areas. And, you know, you have to start from the beginning when the original people were the only ones here and try to preserve what little's left. Because coastal areas like Cape Ann are very densely populated, you know, a lot of the sites that where we would have inhabited or occupied prior to colonization have been impacted and developed. And so towns should each respectively develop archaeological bylaws and zoning bylaws that require some sort of archaeology and are based on town-wide sensitivity assessments and things of that nature, that a lot of towns have gone through that process through community preservation funding and developed town-wide sensitivity assessments. Some are more comprehensive than others that are inclusive of archaeological and pre-contact sensitivity assessments. And if they haven't done so, then they should take that next step and then
develop
GIS maps that can correlate sensitivity.
Thank you, David. That's David Whedon, Tribal Historic Preservation Officer for the Mashpee Wampanoag Tribe, and Oliver Barker, the Director of the Cape Ann Museum. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you again for the opportunity. Take care.
You too. Now, before we move on, we're working on a story about this crazy housing market, folks. So have you seen unusual living arrangements or maybe paid too much to, say, share someone's basement one bedroom? We want to hear your story. Sign up for texting by sending the word Boston to 617-766-0382. That's 617-766-0382. And then tell us your story. You're listening to the sounds of a new exhibit at the Concord Museum called Alive with Birds. It explores the life and impact of local ornithologist and conservationist William Brewster. Brewster was also the first president of the Mass Audubon, who is co-organizing the event. The works are on display now until September. So with us now to talk more about the exhibit, David Wood, curator at the Concord Museum. David, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you.
So who is this exhibit for? Is this for birders or a broader population? Tell me.
I think a broader population, in that obviously the birds are the center of the thing, as it was for Brewster, but the place itself has its own wonderful quality that we are trying to share through this exhibition. And the bird art itself functions quite well as art independently of the subject, in a way, if you know what I mean. So I think it will be of interest to a broader audience. There's a historical factor to this as well, that about a third of the exhibition is about this extraordinary experiment that that Brewster set up. And so I think for
So let's talk about that. Let's actually stay right there. This, you just referred to it as an extraordinary experiment. And really it was, right? So briefly tell us that.
Starting in 1895, Brewster began to assemble what ended up being a total of about 300 acres in Concord, right on a bend of the river. His aims were not completely articulated in the beginning, I think, but before too long, it led to a radical change in the way that Brewster himself studied birds. The way you studied a bird in the 19th century was you shot it, and then you took your non-moving specimen to your book and figured out what species you had. And no other kind of observation was recognized as scientifically valid.
So if you didn't kill the bird, it wasn't valid?
In a sense, yes. Yes, I would say that is the case. And Brewster was also involved in assembling the collections at the Museum of Comparative Zoology, which was, this is a broader educational undertaking. The MCZ was collecting specimens from all over the world, trying to figure out what's the entirety of the universe look like when you're talking about life. And so it was a part of that as well. Brewster decided he didn't want to shoot the birds anymore. His land in Concord was a good place to study the living bird and learn then from their behavior and so following things that you could never learn from the stuffed specimen.
And that really did influence, and this is part of that intersection between Mass Audubon and what you're doing at the museum, that did influence birding and the study of birds in the years to come.
It did. The binoculars supplanted the shotgun.
Amazing. Sorry, you just struck me with that. I'd not thought of it that way. How much change would come when binoculars supplant a shotgun as part of scientific method?
Yes.
All right.
And Brewster was aware of that. I mean, this is a self-conscious undertaking on his part. And in part, it's to celebrate that we've collaborated with Mass Audubon on this exhibition.
And the collaboration also comes, as I understand it. So you mentioned the fact that he had 300 acres in Concord. So that's the Concord part. But then a few years ago, almost half of that went as a gift to Mass Audubon. And that's the Mass Audubon part that gave you a chance to come together, right?
Exactly. And that in part was the origin of this exhibition, though in fact, for Mass Audubon Centennial, we hosted an exhibition here at the museum, which was a collaboration with the Museum of American Bird Art, which is the Mass Audubon collection of bird art. So honestly, we weren't satisfied with our treatment of the subject then. And so here's our opportunity to try it one more time. But clearly, the Nancy Bukas's gift of 106 acres really impelled us to renew that conversation with Mass Audubon and see what can we do to celebrate this extraordinary gift.
So you've also got in the exhibit 20 paintings and sculptures from Mass Audubon's Museum of American Bird Art, and you feature contributions by Robert Gilbert, who was a Black ornithologist who was Brewster's assistant for over 20 years. So in just, you know, briefly, what would we see when we come to the exhibit?
Principally the visual is the art on the walls, but also the feature. You played some of the music in the beginning there. That's a media element in the museum, which merges together contemporary video of the site with some of the black and white images that that Brewster took, in some cases with the assistance of Mr. Gilbert, though actually Gilbert's assistance went far, far beyond the photography and led Mr. Gilbert to say late in life when talking about those days in Concord, those were the good old days. So I think Mr. Gilbert with Brewster was aware of their pioneering. This was new science that they were undertaking, one more sensitive to the environment than previously. And I get the impression, I think you can see it in the gallery. They knew it. They knew they were venturing on to something new.
And the exhibit's there through the beginning of September?
That's correct.
All right. That is David Wood, curator at the Concord Museum. And you can see some photos from the exhibit. Make sure to visit wbur.org/Radio Boston. David Wood, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Okay, so as we wrap today, folks, I wanted to make sure that you heard the news. Starting May 9th, Radio Boston, we will air live at 11 a.m. here on WBUR. But don't worry, if you are a 3 o'clocker, if that's when you listen, you can catch us then too. We cannot wait to be part of your morning, if that's an option for you, or to remain part of your afternoon. There's more information coming on our inaugural week, so keep an ear out for that. And now before we go, we are saying goodbye today to producer Walter Wuthman. Walt is leaving us this week to become a general reporter, and we will miss him, but you won't, because he's staying here at WBUR, which is great. Walt's breadth of experience and intellectual curiosity made him a joy to work with. I'm a huge Walt fan. So to go out, we want to share one of our favorite moments from Walt back in 2020, talking with the Radio Boston team about his high school job back in California.
I don't know if I've told you guys this. I worked at an aquarium in high school.
Oh my God.
So like,
what?
Yeah. So the fish.
You don't share enough.
Yeah. What did you do at the aquarium?
I was a volunteer high school docent. So I like stood behind a touch pool and I explained the sea stars and the sea cucumbers.
Wow.
And
you
sea
were disseminating information then and now.
Exactly. Some people call them starfish. They're not fish.
Really?
They're not fish?
So at the Monterey Bay Aquarium, we were adamant that they were sea stars, not starfish.
This is the first time.
Yeah. I don't think I've ever heard sea
and
stars.
And what's the difference?
Yeah, a sea star is an invertebrate. A fish is a vertebrate. It has a backbone.
You are a special star yourself, Walt. We're excited for you. Good luck. And that's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Tiziana Deering. So glad you joined us to listen today. How about you do it again tomorrow when we'll have more Radio Boston?